this week for From Out of the City, coming to you as always from www.cityoflegends.com. Sit back, relax, and join us. Welcome to this week's From Out of the City. This is William F. DeVault, sometimes known as the romantic poet of the internet. And tonight we have a repeat guest, my good friend and poetic peer, Daniel McTaggart, who's here to mercilessly pimp his upcoming book, which is entitled Midnight Muse in the Convenience Store, correct?
Midnight Muse in a convenience store.
In a convenience store. Shows how much attention I've been paying.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, Dan's going to present some of the works. We're going to discuss them a little bit. And we're just trying to get you guys wedded for it. This book should be coming out within about the next 6 weeks. And I personally feel that, aside from my own books, you should spend all your money just buying as many copies as possible of his books. That's just my opinion.
It sounds good to me.
It sounds good to me, too. So, anyway, if you want to take it from here, Dan, just let us know what you've got and unleash it for us.
Okay. The first poem I'd read would be called Midnight Shift, just to sort of take us into the theme of midnight before I get to any of the other works.
Sounds good to me.
Okay.
Let us have it.
Midnight Shift. When there is no noise at midnight, there is no breakwater against the expansion of the senses. Nothing to stop us from seeing sounds we miss during the day. Darkness tells us trees do not fight the wind, but welcome it, bending to tips of invisible fingers strumming ancient instruments. Each tree may be a different tune, but there is something more to the clatter of leaves clapping in the breeze, almost as if a message were being passed along, a language only the most delicate of attentions could ever unwittingly discern, something we cannot spell with our clumsy tongues, but enough to shift our senses to the swing of a branch and say, that was no mere bob in the wind. That was a word.
I like that. I think there you're creating the sense of the real world. Gotta learn how to pronounce my words. The real world as metaphor for the language. And I think that's a very profound statement in terms of the world of poetry, because I think that they're practically interchangeable, the world of poetry and the world of the visible reality.
Mm-hmm.
We sometimes don't embrace the poetic in the world around us, but it's everywhere. And poetry should reflect that reality that we live in. It's not all fantasy. I mean, even in my most high-flown metaphors and illusions, there's some anchor to the real world, because that's where my perceptions are based. I like that. I like that a great deal.
Yeah, what I'm trying to get across in that one is that poetry is a subtle thing. There's, like you said, there's so much of it around us, and it's so easy to miss.
Poetry is more than just language.
Yes. It's feeling, it's sounds and smell, it's everything around us, but it's so fragile, we steamroll over it.
Yeah.
Unless we learn how to fine-tune our senses to it.
Well, you and I were looking at a poetry book this evening. We were out at a bookstore, Barnes & Noble, and we were looking through the poetry section, and we hit a book of poetry, which I won't mention because I don't want anybody to be mad at me. And I read a poem out loud from it, and the words were well constructed. But poetry isn't just words. Poetry is resonance and reference and connection and description and transcendence. And this was just a little piece of a father talking to his son about how wonderful he was. But I don't think even the word wonderful appeared in the poem. I mean, nothing that stretched the vision, nothing that communicated the vision actually appeared in the work. And I found it rather disappointing. And I think I commented to you at the time that this is very nice, but this isn't poetry, because poetry is grander than that.
Yes.
I mean, the simplicity, even in a haiku by its very nature, although I've gone on record before of not being a huge fan of haiku, because there's a lot of really bad haiku out there. There's some beautiful stuff. But even the simplest haikus, you're drawing to a large extent a metaphor or illusion or connection with reality and with words that is transcendent and beautiful and resonant. Whereas this one piece that I was reading just...
It was a lot of beautiful words, but that was about it. It didn't have anything concrete.
I don't even know if I'd even say beautiful. I would say pretty.
Well, they're arranged in cute. They're arranged in a pretty way, I guess you could say.
Well, you know what my mom used to always say about the word cute? Whenever someone would ask, describe a girl as cute, I'd like your son to meet my cousin. She's really cute. My mom would say, cute is bow-legged. She used to always say that, and the other thing mom used to always say was, country girls are ornery. And I found that out, so. All right, Dan, enough about my dating habits when I was a teenager. Let's get on to more of your work, because we're plugging your book, not my life story.
Okay. And this poem is called On the Pennsylvania Turnpike. It's basically about a memory of a car crash I witnessed when I was around 4 years old. One of my first memories that I can recall clearly, one of my strongest memories. Probably a little too harsh for a four-year-old boy, but it's probably one of the reasons why I write today, because I can recall it so clearly.
Okay, well, please.
So, here it is. By the road, a blue car's front end was crumpled. A blonde woman slumped forward in the passenger seat peacefully. In our front seat, an old man in a blanket sits moaning. Blood laced over his bald, freckled head. A mustached stranger sits with him. He asked my brother and I about school. Mom and Dad are outside, hovering around the mangled car. Mom presses the woman's temple. She is still asleep. A small creek carries away leaking gasoline. The stranger asks how old we are. I let my brother speak. My attention is drawn to the blood and the old man glistening as he moans.
That's a very powerful image.
He was the driver of the car.
Mm-hmm.
And he sat in our front seat. And, of course, his head was covered with blood. And one of the another bystander who stopped by the accident sat in the car with us, because my dad had to be outside with my mom. It's just, he had to be out there with her to watch over her. Right. But my mom asked someone else to sit in the car with my brother and I to help keep us calm. And he asked us, how old you are, where do you go to school, questions that, just to keep you calm. But, how calm can you be when an old man sits bleeding in front of you?
Yeah.
And one of the things I did not know until recently, as I noted in one of the lines of this poem, is right next to the car, gasoline was leaking out. I did not know that. If something had happened, that car could have gone boom.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just that was another element to my memory that I never realized. I think I may have smelled it back then, but I never made a connection to it.
Well, I remember when I was a child, between about the ages of 6 and 10, my father was in the Air Force and stationed in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, Kinchlow Air Force Base. And my parents' family came from Morgantown, West Virginia area. And every summer, Dad would take a few weeks off and we'd drive down here. It was about a two-day drive. And we would take portions of the Ohio Turnpike and the Pennsylvania Turnpike.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember those vividly, but my first strongest memory, I think, of the turnpikes was a story that came on the news one summer, about the same time we drove down, about a woman and her son in a car driving on the Ohio Turnpike, and somebody dropped a bowling ball off an overpass, and it came through the windshield, hit the woman who was driving in the chest, and killed her.
Hmm.
And I don't think they ever caught the people who did that. But I mean, it got me very upset. I was probably 8 or 9 at the time. And I remember for years after that, always watching at overpasses, just in case. But I mean, the long stretches of the road with the boredom and with the cars whizzing by so fast, and just the many hours you spent there, you know, there's a lot of great observational material on the open road, like there is flying in an airplane.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of strong visuals you can get from just being on an airplane for a few hours and looking out the window, even at night, when there's just seemingly blackness. If you let your eyes focus, you can pick up little things. Those little things, like cities. I remember once flying out of Denver Airport on the 4th of July, and there were fireworks shows going off all over the city. This was the night of 4th of July. And of course, we were rising above where any fireworks would be. So the fireworks were actually going off below us, between us and the lights of the city. Very fascinating little sight to see.
Hmm.
I like that piece. I like that piece a lot because it reminds me a lot of my childhood, those times spent driving along on the turnpike.
Poems about strong memories tend to lead the way for strong memories of your own to flood forth.
Mm-hmm. I don't think I thought about that story about that bowling ball for probably the last 5 or 10 years.
Yeah.
Okay, well, what do you have next for us, Dan? That's interesting.
Yeah.
What do you call that?
Oh. I call it...
There's probably going to be a whole school of poets rise up around that. You know that.
Instead of slam poetry, it's going to be phlegm poetry.
Mm. No, thank
Bad
you.
Bad joke.
No, thank you. No, thank you. All right, what's up next?
Okay, this was a poem that I submitted to an e-zine on the web. It was called Flaming Asian Ink. It is now simply called Ink.
I like Flaming Asian Ink.
Yeah, well, it's still up on their webpage, but if you find them on the web, I'm in issue number 7.
Wow.
October 2003, I believe.
I think my favorite name for a poetry or literary magazine was the... one a few years ago. I don't know if they're still in production. Exquisite Corpse. I just thought that was such a terrific name for a magazine.
Some of my earliest published poems were in the WVU literary magazine, Screaming Zebra.
Actually, the first literary magazine that picked up any of my works was a small literary magazine out of Pennsylvania called The Rose's Hope. And it's funny, I'd sent 3 or 4 of my best works, and then because they wanted X number of poems, I threw in a throwaway piece. Nevermore My Steel. They printed Nevermore My Steel. All right, so let's get on with it. What's next?
Okay, this poem is called Electric Tang. Aimless midnight gusts dart across lonely paved lanes while streetlights hum with electric tang. Strolling lovers bathe and lull in a tart glow as they scuff sandaled feet along littered avenues. At some point amidst the phosphorescent buzzing, in the air a low chuckle is muffled in the darkness.
I like that. That strikes a picture in my mind. When you say electric tang, you're speaking of the orangish glow to them, correct?
Yes.
That's interesting.
Tang usually brings about an orange image to the mind, because, you know... That's what we all drank when we were kids.
More than that, I remember one time when I was cooking, when I was married the first time, I wanted to make some fudge, and I was out of sugar. And I figured, well, Tang's mostly sugar. So I substituted Tang for the sugar in the fudge recipe, and we got this light orange, very tasty fudge. It was actually quite good. Strange the things you remember.
Yeah.
So, okay, and so as not to completely take over with my reminiscences... what's next, or...
I thought I would read the title poem.
From the book, which is...
Midnight Muse in a Convenience Store.
In a convenience store. No matter what I say, it's in a convenience store. Unless I decide to change the title and call it something else long enough that, to the point that you all just call it that and he has to give up. Sort of like Gertrude Stein's poem, Scared Emily. The opening line is, Rose is a rose is a rose. Because she's talking about a woman. And it's misquoted so often to a rose is a rose is a rose, which is meaningless in the context of the poem. A lot of the best-known lines in poetry, in literature, are actual misquotes.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Dan.
Alrighty. Midnight muse in a convenience store. She saunters through the door, accompanied by a breath of smoke, her summer dress swaying to the whims of her hips and the tug of her breasts. Slowly she strides the aisles, skidding her sandaled feet as she pauses by the milk. Her head lolls over her shoulder like a lazy flower. She opens the cooler door, slender, painted fingers reach up, threading long auburn hair, which falls in a gossamer fan across her small back. After taking a gallon of milk, her hand briskly rubs a tanned, tender calf, brushing away a sharp chill to no avail as it slithers up along her limber frame, demanding a sultry shiver. She asks for the time, her voice a feathery husk, her smile a slim smirk, her oval eyes like echoes flooding with green.
I like that. Again, your poetry is very observational, which is something I've never mastered. I can't take a snapshot. I have to expound, you know. And I respect that. I mean, there's some very good poets out there, yourself included, who have that ability to create a snapshot. I sometimes call them imagists because they take the snapshot, they take the photograph, they describe an image, and when you hear their stuff, a visible image comes to mind. I mean, I can see the woman in my mind's eye.
A lot of poets write better in solitude. Myself, I tend to write better when I'm around a lot of people, which is why I go to bookstores and coffee shops a lot. I don't drink coffee, but there's so much poetry going on around you in a coffee shop. You can get a poem out of a woman chasing her child around the coffee shop, you know, trying to catch him before he pulls his pants down.
Or,
which actually happened one day.
Or you can get a really good poem out of being chased around a coffee shop by a woman who's trying to pull your pants down. Oh, no, those are my poems. Okay. I like that poem. I think this book is going to be terrific because the style of your work, it's almost like a volume of photographs. It's almost like a coffee table book of images of the real world. And I think that a lot of poets, myself included, have lost that touch, that ability to take the snapshot and to present it without too much embellishment, without too much commentary. You know, I'll take a flower and I'll give you 16 lines on what it means to me. You'll take a flower and give us 8 lines on what it looks like and smells like and feels like. And at the end of the day, you know, you can make all the value judgments you want about one type or another being better. But the bottom line is we need people who report on the real world. And I think you're a very strong connection between poetry and real life. And I think that's a very admirable trait. It's something I can't do.
Oh, thank you.
So, anyway, you have a bonus poem for us.
Yes, a DVD extra, so to speak. This is a poem that I wrote during my midnight shifts at the gas station. And I cut it from the book because it was too long.
I was going to say you cut it because it was a gratuitous sex scene, wasn't it?
No.
Oh, bummer.
No, sorry to disappoint you. My intention for the book is to have one poem per page and have the white area on the bottom of the page be the silence between the previous poem and the next poem. And I just felt like a two-page poem would disrupt the rhythm of the book. And this poem would be at least 2 pages, maybe a little bit longer.
Oh, so we got a long one coming up. Well, I'm going to take a nap while you go. No, just kidding. Go ahead and let us have it. And what's the name of the work?
It's called Peanut Butter.
Now, will this poem stick to the roof of my mouth?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Actually, Peanut Butter would be a great name for a book. Maybe your next book should be called Peanut Butter.
Possibly.
If so, I get royalties on it because I came up with the idea for the title.
Well, in that case, I won't use it.
Oh, okay. Well, fire away whenever you're ready, Dan.
Okay. A man came in tonight talking about the races and why he thinks they should be kept separate. He said, if the races keep mixing, one day everybody's going to be peanut butter complected. You mark my words, peanut butter. And mark his words I did, with not a lot of concern. I wanted to tell him, how do you know we aren't already? I wanted to ask him, if you're not peanut butter now, what do you care? I've shaken many hands of a different color, and it doesn't rub off, I can tell you that. And every one was as warm and friendly as mine. I didn't tell him anything. He winked as if he thought I was shocked, so I let him think that I was. It made him happy, and I'd shut him up. So he sat down by the window, staring out at the empty night. A car's headlights caught him right between the eyes, but he did not blink. He crossed the legs of his torn and tattered jeans, dangling untied laces from a muck-encrusted boot. He draped one arm over the back of his seat and laid the other across his lap, covering the gray belly hair poking out of holes eaten by moths and stray cigarette ashes. His pale whiskers bristled as he rubbed his gums with rugged confidence. And he looked proud. Proud, I tell you.
I've met a lot of people like that. I can just see the guy, the untied boot laces, the gray belly hairs, the little cigarette burn holes in their clothes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that sort of brutish confidence that what they think is the real worldview.
Yeah.
They would never stoop to debate because they are so convinced that everything they know is so absolutely true that the mere notion of learning something new, prideful ignorance. I like that.
What struck me about this man was he was not a mean-spirited person. He never used any racial epithets. But this is what he firmly believed. And as he was telling me his little story, you know, I just had to remark his appearance. He was obviously a working man. He worked during the night. He wore rough and tattered clothes. And he just had a feeling to his words I had to capture, even if I didn't necessarily agree with him.
I understand that completely. Well, is there anything else you'd like to tell us about this forthcoming book?
Well, I'm hoping to put it to bed before the end of the month. I would like it to come out in time for National Poetry Month. I think that would probably be good timing for a book to come out.
I agree. My 8 books, I've targeted 3 of them to be released during National Poetry Month.
Yes.
I just think it's the logical time to launch.
I think I probably would have put this book out a little sooner, but I've been adding some poems to the book.
Just be careful you don't take that too far. I have a tendency to do that myself.
I've added all I'm going to add. I probably added about 10 or 11 more poems than I had before. And I think that's probably a good amount. It's around 60 poems.
Okay. Well, we're looking forward to it. Again, my guest has been Daniel S. McTaggart. Pimping his book, Midnight Muse, in the
A
convenience store. It'll be coming out during the month of April. You can check for information on it at my website, www.cityoflegends.com, and just out there on the web in general, and at lulu.com, who's going to be the publisher. And that's about it for tonight. Again, thank you, Dan, for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for sharing your works. And that's about it for us for tonight. So thank you for listening to this week's episode of From Out of the City. And we hope to see you next week. Take care.